city is holding a vigil to honor top Iranian and Iraqi commanders General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, assassinated by the U.S. in 2020. Iran and the remaining signatories to the JCPOA are set to resume their talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. President Joe Biden reiterates his warning that the U.S. and its allies will, quote, respond decisively if Russia invades Ukraine. Those were the top stories. Welcome. Monday, January the 3rd, marks the second anniversary of the assassination of top Iranian military commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, by the United States. Ceremonies are being held in Iran and elsewhere, including Yemen, Syria, and Iraq, to name a few. To commemorate the occasion, in Iraq, people held a vigil outside Baghdad's international airport on Sunday to pay tribute to the top Iranian general and senior Iraqi commander, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, who was assassinated alongside General Soleimani. A rally was also held in the Iraqi capital on Saturday to remember the two anti-terror icons. Iraqis also reiterated their call for the withdrawal of U.S. forces from their country. Only 2 days after the assassinations, Iraqi parliamentarians passed a bill demanding the government to expel American forces. Last month, the U.S. announced the end of its combat mission in Iraq, limiting it to an advisory role. People in Toronto have held a vigil to honor General Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. Human rights activist Faraz al-Najim, who joined from the Canadian city, says the UN has failed to take action on the assassination by the U.S. of the top commanders because it is being controlled by the West.
The United Nations is run by these superpowers and these criminals, and they have a very strong hold on them, and they're very biased, unfortunately. We see that in many places, such as Palestine. You know, the Israeli Zionist regime. We see what's going on in Kashmir, with them very silent. We see what's going on in Yemen, the worst humanitarian crisis. So, you know, everywhere in the world, in Nigeria, everywhere we see criminal acts happening by tyrants, you know, and that they have support of the U.S. and their allies, the British and so on, that they're very silent and they're very quiet and they don't do nothing about it. And unfortunately, this is the way it is. We have lost trust in the United Nations. All these people here, we've seen for many years so many violations that happen, and we don't see any action, any justice, you know, any sanctions. Like, there's nothing going on. The U.S. it still has a green light to cause any kind of criminal act to invade any country, and they fabricate any type of justification to go and invade another country and kill its citizens and so on. But the Iraqis today came out in thousands and millions, and this showed a sign. And also Qasem Soleimani's daughter was in Iraq, Zainab Soleimani, and she stood up and said that the only solution to this situation is for the Americans and their troops to evacuate Iraq immediately.
Iran and several other countries are making the second anniversary, or marking the second anniversary, of the U.S. assassination of the legendary anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has described General Soleimani as a role model and a hero for the younger generation, not only in Iran, but around the world.
Iran begins marking the second anniversary of the U.S. assassination of the legendary anti-terror commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. In a meeting with General Soleimani's family in Tehran, leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said General Soleimani has turned into a role model and a hero for the younger generation. Meanwhile, tens of thousands have taken part in ceremonies to pay tribute to the highly charismatic commander.
Soleimani was commander who did not allow the terrorists to approach our borders. He defeated Daesh in Iraq and Syria, so the entire region always owes him a big thank. American politicians thought that by killing General Soleimani, they would be able to let the terrorists win, but we are all going to preserve his legacy.
Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said the enemies were under the delusion that with the martyrdom of General Soleimani, quote, they would be done with their job. However, the U.S. fled Afghanistan as a result of the sacrifices made by Soleimani.
Afghan youth learned many lessons from him. Today, all the freedom-seeking people in the world regard him as a role model.
All Afghan people should follow his path, and he is in our hearts. We all look at him as someone who defeated arrogant powers.
Ayatollah Khamenei also said Washington is inevitably pulling out of Iraq and only has an advisory role there, without any military presence. Iran's leader warned Iraqi officials to be vigilant about the issue. On Saturday, Iraqis held rallies on the streets of the capital, Baghdad, to honor top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani and senior Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, both assassinated by the U.S. 2 years ago. Demonstrators called for the withdrawal of American forces from the country. Ayatollah Khamenei added the resistance front in Yemen is making gains, while the enemy has been brought to its knees in Syria. The leader, on Saturday, touched on the participation of tens of millions of people in Iraq, Iran and other countries in the funeral and the processions held for General Soleimani after his assassination. General Soleimani is hailed as a hero of the fight against terrorism by people across the globe. The Islamic movement in Nigeria described General Soleimani as a hero of coordination between Christian and Muslim religions, leading victory over Daesh in Iraq and Syria. Also, Bolivia ex-president Evo Morales described General Soleimani as a hero in the fight against imperialism. The top Iranian anti-terror commander's assassination also exposed the U.S.'s support for terrorist groups and Washington's lies of countering terrorism.
The assassination of General Soleimani amounted to a target killing or targeted killing in another country, an act that is illegal under international law. The government of Iraq, as the country where the assassination took place, denounced the move. Even the U.S. Congress did not approve the strike. Donald Trump, the then president, could not prove that Soleimani had been an imminent threat, making the move illegal and condemned worldwide.
Iran has called on the United Nations to adopt a resolution condemning those behind the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian president's office has made the call in a letter to the president of the UN General Assembly, saying the impunity granted to the perpetrators of the drone strike poses a threat to international peace and security. It stresses that attacks on government and diplomatic officials are crimes against humanity and violate the UN Charter and international law on human rights. It warns that inaction on state terrorism can lead to devastating consequences for the international community.
That type of extra-legal activity really was emphasized and came forward in a way that it had never seen before, basically to assassinate people in the middle of essentially a diplomatic mission in another country. And that's simply not possible to continue like that. And the response, of course, in Iraq was fury and the demand that the United States get out. So clearly, it's the wrong way to go from a whole variety of reasons, but especially a moral reason.
Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, was assassinated along with his companions, including Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, in a U.S. terrorist drone strike near the Baghdad International Airport on January 3, 2020. But the U.S. was not alone in committing this heinous crime. Israel provided Washington with the key intelligence support, including tracking General Soleimani's cell phone. General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis were two iconic figures in the fight against the Daesh terrorist group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Both commanders were admired by Muslim nations for eliminating the U.S.-sponsored Daesh Takfiri terrorist group in the region, particularly in Iraq and Syria. Days after the brazen act, the Islamic Revolution Guard Corps launched a volley of missiles at two major military bases housing American forces in Iraq, Iran denounced the assassination as a state terrorism and vowed to end the American presence in the region as the ultimate act of revenge. The U.S. assassination drew a wave of condemnation from officials and movements through the world and triggered huge public protests across the region.
Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal are set to resume their talks in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The eighth round of talks, which was adjourned on Thursday for New Year's holidays, the participants are negotiating a possible revival of the deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Diplomats have welcomed the progress made during the latest round. They're expected to discuss Tehran's proposals on sanctions removal and its nuclear commitments. Iran wants all U.S. sanctions removed in a verifiable manner. The Islamic Republic is also seeking guarantees that Washington will not withdraw from the accord again as it did in 2018. Fresh Saudi airstrikes on Yemen leave at least five civilians dead and several wounded. Three people were killed in air raids on a mosque in Ma'ain district in Sana'a province early on Sunday. The mosque was completely destroyed in the attack. A number of nearby homes and a school were also damaged. Saudi warplanes also targeted a gas station in Bihan district of Shabwa province. The attack killed two staff members of the Yemeni oil ministry. Saudi Arabia frequently targets civilian areas in Yemen since launching a war on the impoverished nation back in 2015. There's no end in sight to Washington-Moscow tensions over Ukraine. U.S. President Joe Biden reiterates his country's support for Ukraine in case of any Russian invasion on the country. According to the White House press secretary, Biden made the pledge during a telephone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky. The U.S. president said Washington and its allies would, quote, respond decisively if Russia moves to invade Ukraine. That's days after Biden held a second conversation in a month with Russian President Vladimir Putin amid tensions on the Russian-Ukrainian border. The U.S.-led NATO military alliance claims Moscow is building up troops on its border with the intention to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies the allegations, saying its troops' movement is aimed at securing its own territories. Political commentator Mr. Jason Androhe says Washington is seeking to find a pretext for deploying the U.S.-led NATO forces in Ukraine.
I think for now, this is definitely a war of wars. Essentially, what we have is a situation where there are areas of Ukraine that have decided to split off. Once there was what is essentially a Nazi coup inside of the country and fascists took power, these two areas, which are predominantly Russian, did decide to break off. They had a vote to rejoin Russia, to separate, etc. Now, their breaking off is something that the United States, or specifically the proxy forces inside of Ukraine, cannot afford to have happen. So, essentially, we have a situation where these break-off provinces have requested Russian help because they are also ethnic Russians to defend them in case they get invaded. So the Russian forces are about 200 kilometers from the border with Ukraine, while the United States is seeing this as a justification to send NATO forces into the country. But essentially what we have here is a situation where Russia is not going to go in and do anything unless NATO goes in and tries to force those areas to come back to the country. So the ball in this situation is certainly in the U.S. court.
It is now France's turn to take the helm of presidency of the Council of the European Union for the next 6 months. French President Macron has always been staunchly pro-Europe, but he may become quite distracted by his re-election bid in April. Robin Mazohiri has that story from Paris.
France has assumed the rotating presidency of the Council of the European Union for the next 6 months, with Emmanuel Macron promising to make the world's largest common market into a more influential and independent bloc. Yet the European Union begins 2022 beset by major difficulties. The open wound of Brexit, marginalization in global geopolitics, an uncertain post-corona economic future coming on the heels of a lost decade of economic growth, and deep divisions on the issues of immigration, right-wing economics, and relations with Moscow. The European Union appears to be at a crossroads. With Angela Merkel finally stepping down, there is no clear leader or figurehead. Emmanuel Macron wants to assume her mantle, but many say that his liberal strongman approach to the Yellow Vests has reinforced perceptions that the EU is not just non-democratic, but anti-democratic. Historically, no country's elite has been more pro-Europe than in France, and no French leader has been more pro-EU than Macron. However, analysts remind that Macron only has the power to push the EU's agenda in a certain direction and not to decide policy unilaterally, as he has often done in France.
It's a bit egotistical and ethnocentric to think that France will be able to accomplish anything more than Slovenia, Sweden, or any of the other previous heads of the European Union. So, in the matter of a common defense policy, of a green energy transition, of economic regulation, of ending economic stagnation, Macron won't be able to accomplish in 6 months anything which Brussels hasn't been able to achieve in the past 10 years.
With a tightly contested presidential election looming in April, it seems certain that Macron's continental-sized ambitions will be constrained by domestic politics.
C'est plus un obstacle.
I think Macron will find the rotating presidency to actually be an obstacle to his re-election ambitions. Representing the interests of 70 million Frenchmen and also 450 million citizens of the European Union, and also being a candidate running for re-election, are three very different hats to wear. He will find himself in many conflicting positions.
The philosophy of Angela Merkel was marked by avoiding tough solutions to social questions while also demanding right-wing economic changes. As the EU emerges into a very different post-corona world, Europe may be demanding different solutions and possibly even different leaders before France's rotating presidency is over. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
And that's it with international news. Stay tuned.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you. Early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
More Afghan people may die from U.S. sanctions against their country. The ongoing famine crisis and the destruction of what remains of the Afghan economy could result in the deaths of millions of people, says Li Fang, writer, in an article published under the heading Humanitarian Exemptions to Crushing U.S. Sanctions Do Little to Prevent Collapse of Afghanistan's Economy. Stay tuned for more. Pulled out of Afghanistan in August, ceding to the Taliban, the country's economy began a severe contraction, what the Financial Times calls one of the worst economic meltdowns in history. The sprawling crisis has left nearly 23 million people in extreme hunger, and at least 1 million children under the age of 5 are now facing the immediate threat of starvation, according to the United Nations. As commerce ground to a halt, food and fuel prices skyrocketed in large part due to economic sanctions placed on the Taliban by the U.S. regime. As many as 300,000 Afghans have fled to neighboring Pakistan, and many more refugees may soon leave the country. The Biden administration defends the sanctions by pointing to a series of exemptions designed to allow humanitarian aid. The Treasury Department has touted its role as a leading humanitarian donor to the people of Afghanistan and its work to ensure that funds flow through legitimate and transparent channels via official sanction exemption licenses. But those humanitarian exemptions, overseen by the Treasury's Office of Foreign Assets Control, are nowhere near enough. According to experts who spoke to The Intercept, the OFAC licenses, including new licenses released on December 22, 2021, have not curbed the global chilling effect of the sanctions and are ineffective in preventing a spiraling disaster that could kill more Afghan people than nearly 20 years of U.S.-backed war and occupation. Businesses and individuals that violate U.S. sanctions on the Taliban risk steep fines and criminal penalties. The broad sanctions imposed by the U.S. lack specificity and raise the possibility that routine commercial activities in Afghanistan could fall under sanctions policy. None of these OFAC licenses, none of them address the issue of international banks in their dealing with Afghan banks, hesitancy to deal with Afghan taxes, banking transactions for commercial imports, said Shah Mehrabi, a member of Afghanistan Central Bank Board, adding, the sanctions have created a lot of fear in the minds of those who do not want to go ahead and engage in taking this particular risk. OFAC has issued licenses for medicine, remittances, education, salaries, and other forms of humanitarian assistance. Additional licenses released recently allow exemptions for education funds and expand the scope of U.S. funds to aid organizations in Afghanistan. Mehrabi, who teaches economy at Montgomery College in Maryland, noted that much of Afghanistan's domestic economy faces impending failure, a problem that cannot be solved by merely allowing humanitarian aid to flow. The U.S. Treasury Department added Mehrabi has focused on piecemeal humanitarian exemptions and has not addressed the central issue of how Afghanistan can import and export goods, collect taxes, and pay salaries. Mehrabi said, we are talking about an economy that's going to collapse if Treasury does not clarify what could be done to the liquidity issue. When the Taliban seized control of Afghanistan in August 2021, U.S. sanctions imposed since 2002 that criminalize any form of support for the Taliban as a specially designated global terrorist group suddenly meant that penalties could apply to leaders of a sovereign state. As U.S. forces withdrew, American law firms quickly alerted international institutions across the globe that any business transaction in Afghanistan could risk violating sanctions. Any routine tax payment or duty paid to an Afghan bureaucrat could be construed as aiding and abetting the Taliban. Even if the Treasury Secretary does not specifically designate the entire government of Afghanistan, it will be very difficult for contractors and grantees to know whether standard transaction with the government of Afghanistan, such as paying taxes, permit fees, utility fees, import duties, or other routine payments, will result in funds passing to the Taliban, or its leaders in control of various branches of the Afghan government, noted a client alert from the law firm Nicholas Liu. Contractors and businesses, the firm noted, can expect banks to de-risk from Afghanistan, meaning that fund transfers to or from Afghanistan will be intercepted by intermediary banks and blocked until the contractor or grantee can demonstrate that the specific transfer to and the use of funds in Afghanistan will comply with U.S. sanctions. The banking industry is reading the sanctions as the entire government is now the Taliban, a former U.S. Treasury Department official told the crisis group. The far-reaching sanctions, along with a Biden administration decision to freeze nearly $10 billion of Afghanistan's central bank national reserves, sent the economy into free fall. Payments to doctors and police stopped. Hospitals ran out of medicine. Residents could not withdraw bank deposits. Even a printing press in Poland contracted to print Afghanis, the local currency, could not deliver its shipment. Rajiv Agrawal, the chief financial officer of KEC International, an Indian firm tapped to build electric utility transmission lines in Afghanistan, told investors in October that his five projects in the country suddenly ceased payments in August. Agrawal reported the U.S. has choked all the funding lines to Afghanistan. Sanctions are intended to have a chilling effect in that sanctions will always go beyond the face of the text, said Adam Weinstein, a research fellow with the Quincy Institute for Responsible Spacecraft. No bank or business wants to walk right up to the line when it comes to compliance with U.S. sanctions policy, given that these are risk-averse institutions. Recently, 40 members of the House of Representatives wrote to President Joe Biden, urging him to cease sanctions and release Afghanistan central bank funds controlled by the U.S. regime. No increase in food and medical aid can compensate for the macroeconomic harm of soaring prices of basic commodities, a banking collapse, a balance of payments crisis, a freeze on civil servant salaries, and other severe consequences that are rippling throughout Afghan society, harming the most vulnerable, noted the letter led by Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Sarah J. Cobbs, and Jesus G. Choi Garcia. There is little appetite among politicians in Washington, D.C. to radically reverse course. The Biden administration facing low public approval ratings following the exit from Afghanistan and a tough forecast for the 2022 midterm elections may be continuing sanctions for political reasons. Releasing the sanctions could be viewed as recognition of the Taliban as the legitimate rulers of Afghanistan, a symbolism that could cement negative attitudes about the administration and its Afghanistan policy. Senate Republicans led by Senator Mitt Romney, Utah, and Senator Jim Risch, Idaho, have released demands that the administration go even further in sanctioning the Taliban, including any foreign governments that provide support to Afghanistan. Earlier this month, The Intercept attempt to speak to a number of senators, Democrats and Republicans, about U.S. sanctions fueling widespread famine in Afghanistan. Many refused to talk about the issue.
Food for thought. Hello, dear friends. For your information, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, while referring to a verse in the original Evangel, which God had revealed to Prophet Jesus, peace be upon him, has supplicated to Creator of the universe in the following words. O Allah, I verily beseech you by the ayah by whom you commanded your servant Jesus, the son of Mary, peace be upon him, to call you. Then you answered him, and he revived the dead, cured the blind, and the leper with your permission, and by your revelation he told of mysteries with your grace, kindness, and mercy. Praise be to you, Lord of the heavens and the earth, Lord of the worlds. He is the dominion in the heavens and the earth. He is the magnificent, the wise. Come between us and our enemies and help us against them, O our Master and Lord.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Hello and welcome to another session of Q&A on Islamic beliefs. This is IRIB English Radio and I'm your host. We're going to discuss the animal rights. This is the following session of the two previous sessions. In this session, we're going to discuss about the right of living of the animals. Hello, Dr. Kaimi.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. According to the verse 31 in Surah Al-Kahf, settlers of Eden will be adorned with bracelets of gold, yet wearing gold is forbidden for men in this life. The question is, how is it that men are rewarded with gold in heaven, while they're asked to avoid wearing gold in this life?
Yeah, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. That's true. According to verse 31 of chapter Kaf, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that one of the rewards of the people or the inhabitants of paradise is asawira min dhahab. Let me just quickly read the translation of the verse. For such, there will be the gardens of Eden with streams running in them. They will be adorned therein with bracelets of gold, and wear green garments of silk, and the rest of the verse. So, according to this verse, one of the rewards for the people in paradise, not only women but also the men, is that they will wear some golden jewelries, so to speak.
Yes.
Now, many people ask that, I mean, it's not only this reward. Many people say that, many things that are forbidden in this life, they are the rewards in the hereafter.
Of the other life.
In one of the previous sessions, we talked about sharab or wine. Some people say that it is forbidden in this world, and it is a kind of reward in the paradise. We answered in details that it is absolutely different. So I'm not going to repeat that, but I will, later come to a kind of comparison between that question and today's question. Now, when it comes to why men are not allowed to wear gold in this world, first of all, when it comes to philosophies of Islamic law, there are a couple of points. We should not think that we know all the philosophies of Islamic laws. Yes, to some extent we are told that, for example, for abandoning eating pork, for example, these are some philosophies. But we should not think that we know all the philosophies of Islamic laws. Science, from time to time, it helps us to come to new discoveries. Yes. About the philosophies of Islamic laws, but not all of them. So, when it comes to Islamic laws, we should not expect all the philosophies to be absolutely clear for us. This is one point. The second point is that we should not think that all these philosophies are related to this world. Some of them, they are spiritual. So, the philosophy of some of the Islamic laws is related to spirituality. For fasting, for example, one of them is reaching taqwa or God-weariness. Yes. So, it is also one of the philosophies and wisdoms. Now, this is a kind of introduction to our discussion. Why, going back to the main question, why men are not allowed to wear gold in this world, there are a couple of points mentioned here. The first point is that we should not think that everything that is there in this world, the same situation and the same laws can be applied to the next world. Let me give you an example. Maybe one of the philosophies or this act being forbidden for men is for men to refrain from a kind of show off. Imagine wearing gold is permitted for the men.
Yeah.
Now all the men also try to wear different kinds of gold, which has no, benefit for them. There is no reason for that, for men to do that. For women, there are philosophies, of course. But if men would be allowed, then it may result to a great extravagance done by well-to-do people, and the poor people cannot afford it. So it would
be a show-off.
Exactly, it's a kind of show-off. But on the day of judgment, there is no show-off anymore. People of paradise, they are not going to show-off anymore. So, one point regarding this question is that the conditions are different.
Yes, and everyone has reached what they deserve.
Exactly. So men are not allowed for this reason. Of course, this is one of the reasons. But on the day of judgment, this is not the case, and the conditions are different. The second answer to this question is that we have a mystical understanding of this verse. We know that at the end of the day, what are mentioned in the Quran as the rewards of the Day of Judgment are put in a language that is feasible to us, understandable to us. We can fathom it. But is it the reality of the rewards? We will have, physical fruits.
Yes.
Or gold and so on and so forth.
You mean maybe they have metaphorical meanings?
Not metaphorical, but maybe there are deeper layers of meaning. And right now in this world, we cannot understand the reality. We need to go, wait, and then see the reality.
Yes.
Of all these rewards. I'm not negating the fact that there are physical rewards, for sure, but maybe the reality is different from what we think right now.
Yes.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Inshallah, inshallah,
Having said that, I would like to share the viewpoints of some great mystics regarding this verse. They say that, for example, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala talks about this, golden jewelries, it is referring to understanding the realities of monotheism, meaning that, spiritually speaking, they are adorned with these realities, which are golden realities.
Yes.
So this is another understanding of this verse. The next point is that I would like to go back to what I mentioned regarding sharab and wine, that I said that we talked in details about that in one of the previous sessions. On the Day of Judgment, the word sharab has been mentioned in the Noble Book of Quran as one of the rewards. But we said that, first of all, sharab does not mean necessarily wine. It
yes.
means any kind of drink. So we shouldn't think that wine, alcoholic wine, which is intoxicating, it is forbidden in this world. It is one of the rewards in the hereafter. This is not the case.
And it must have another effect.
Exactly.
The kind of wine they are going to use
exactly.
there is going to be different.
And the verses which talk about khamr, which is roughly translated into wine, other verses, they refer to the features of this kham. For example, it doesn't bring about any headache,
yes.
unlike the wine in this world. It doesn't bring about intoxication, unlike the wine that people consume in this world. So my point is that if there is a kind of similarity in words like kham and wine, but the features and the characteristics are absolutely different,
yes, of
which
course.
Leads us to this conclusion that what is forbidden in this world is something, and what is the reward in the hereafter is
another thing
in nature. So the same thing is about gold. It is a great possibility that, the nature of the gold in the hereafter is not exactly the nature of the gold that we think in this world,
in
and
this
it
world.
Is forbidden for men to wear. And now I would like to share one scientific explanation of this Islamic verdict. According to some researchers, they have done some, researchers about this Islamic law, why men are not allowed to wear gold, but women are allowed.
Yes.
According to some studies, men have more white blood cells than women.
Yes.
Now, if these researchers continue, when the body of the man touches the gold, it somehow increases the number of these white cells. White blood cells. So naturally, as the number of the white blood cells increases, the space for red blood cells
will
decreases.
Be reduced,
yeah.
Yes.
And their number decreases significantly. So using and wearing gold for men would change this balance between the white blood cells and the red ones, and this would bring about some illnesses. For example, according to some, it would lead to anemia in men, and would also cause another illnesses, which is a kind of cancer, the blood cancer, also known as leukemia,
yes,
and all the other kinds of illnesses that can be caused by this
wearing gold.
Exactly, which is leading to a kind of disorder in the number of these cells, and the balance would be, changed. So this is a scientific explanation of why this is forbidden for women, for men, but maybe one argue that the same can happen for women as well. So
yes.
why is it not forbidden for women to wear gold?
Maybe the nature of women is different from the nature of men, that's why.
And the body, according to same research, they have also done some studies about the structure of the body of women and a kind of comparison between that and that of men. Now, according to some researchers, there are some differences between the structure of the body of men and that of the women. When it comes to our discussions, it's been mentioned that in women there is a layer of fat between the skin and the flesh, but this layer is not found in the men. So that very layer of fat is a kind of, barrier between the gold and the body, and those negative effects would not be happen in the body of the women. So I'm not saying that this is the, absolutely, this is the main answer to the question why wearing gold is forbidden in Islam and allowed for women, or even encouraged for women when it comes to them, adoring themselves for their husband, for example. But we may also look at it as one of the possibilities. As I mentioned, some of the scholars in science, they have proved the fact that it has negative effects for men, but not for women. So this is one point, and the other point, I think we shared the fact that the conditions are not the same in this world and in the hereafter. Men are not allowed to wear it, maybe because Islam does not want them to show off.
Yes.
And also the fact that maybe the nature of this gold in the hereafter would be different
from what we know in here. In this world. Yes, thank you. So that was the gist. Technically, every rule in our religion, which is the religion of logic, has got a reason, a scientific background. Thank you for giving us the clarification.
My pleasure.
This was Q&A on Islamic Belief, and this is IRIB English Radio. We had a great time discussing with you. Thank you for listening.
لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في لعلي وحسين وحسن
From the day he started his presidential campaign, US President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the US goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4+1 group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with the US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the chief of staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They were never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty, okay? They shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world, and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing, it's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
There are over 700 lobbyists representing for-profit military contractors in D.C., and this redistribution of wealth is why they are there. Dear listeners, what you heard was part of an article written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading Pentagon Projected to Hand $407 billion to private military contractors this fiscal year. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. U.S. President Joe Biden has signed a record-shattering military budget recently, and a new analysis published recently predicted that if recent contracting trends continue, the Pentagon will funnel $407 billion worth of public funds to private weapons makers this fiscal year, more than the federal government spent when sending $1,400 relief checks to most Americans in 2021.